Broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Listen-only mode.
Cut it open. Okay. So, can you see it?
Yep. Well, okay. I don't know what I see. I just see my screen, so let's see.
Yeah. So you should have the little gray box over on the side.
Nope. Don't see that. Let's see here. There we go. Yeah, I've got that. Okay.
Okay, so you're running the show here, so
Hey, Kimberly, I'm the presenter here. You think?
Telling me.
Yep.
Wait, hang on.
Okay, guys, I've got you on the phone, so I want to make sure that you can hear me on the computer itself.
Okay, he can't hear you, so you need to go onto the audio.
All right.
So there's a whole bunch of...
Hey, I can hear you now, Wade.
You can, okay.
Yeah, and I made you the organizer, so you should be able to control everything now.
Okay, well, that's a bit scary since I don't know how to control anything. The only thing I'm going to do is move down my page. So if I need to do something different,
well,
give me a little instruction.
You've got to share your screen.
All right, let's see here.
So there's a couple of little buttons over on the left side.
So there's
a little mic, and then there's two buttons down as a screen.
Okay, I see that. Two buttons down, screen.
Yep, so okay. Your screen should be shared.
All right, you see it?
Nope.
No? Let's see.
Under sharing, it's show screen.
So I've got the green button. I've got the microphone below that. I've got
in the box itself. See the sharing. It says sharing dashboard attendees.
What am I looking at here?
You see the green, the red, yellow, and blue, red, yellow, and green go to webinar, the dialog box dots. You know, like
I see. Red and a green dot. Don't see a yellow one. Over on the far left side, upper left corner.
So you should, are you looking at the GoToWebinar control panel?
I'm actually on a PC, but it's on a Mac. So it's a Parallels version. Not that that should matter, but
right.
It's running on Windows.
Well, that's fine. You should have a dialog box to control the webinar.
All right.
Just like where your green audio button was, the mute. I think that's what you were.
Yeah. All right. So when I highlight that, it says people can hear you. Click it to mute. So that's on.
No.
Right below it.
Yeah, so it's on. We can hear you. So to the right of that, do you not have a dialog box? There you go.
Okay. So I don't know if you want to, well, obviously you don't want camera.
Now you've got video. Do you just have a strip of buttons or do you have a whole box?
I've got a whole box.
Okay. So show your screen. So sharing, right?
And you drop
down, you click on that little right arrow next to sharing.
It's the right arrow next to sharing.
You should have sharing, dashboard, attendees, audio, webcam.
So I see webcam, yeah, I see audio. Speakers, microphone, phone call. What am I? I mean, I see a button right here that I can click on that shows screen, but that's when I clicked on that, that's when I got the camera. Let me try this one more time, see what happens here.
Hey, wait, I'm gonna disconnect with you. I think you're set with okay. Chris Hill.
Okay, sounds good, thanks. Yeah, so when I click on it, no one can see you. Click this to share your webcam. I don't want a webcam, so make another attendee the presenter. View full screen mode. Yeah, Chris, I'm not sure what I should see.
Well, so you should have a dialog box, and in the top of the dialog box, it'll show Friday Canis Major Specialist Call.
I don't even see the dialog box.
So I don't think it's showing your dialog box correctly. I don't think it's showing your control panel correctly.
Apparently not.
Because you don't have the correct dialog box to.
So the last time we did this, David kind of just took me through it, and all I needed to do was move down my presentation.
Well,
I don't know if you've got to do that.
I can't control your computer. I can't show your screen. You have to show your screen.
Okay, so it's just a matter of showing the screen, and I don't see that.
And I made you the organizer. I'm the presenter. I made you the organizer so you can show your screen. Maybe I need to make you the presenter. Hang on a second.
Yeah, maybe. There you go.
There you go. Okay. I see your screen.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. We live?
We are live.
Okay.
So.
Well, good morning, everybody. I don't know who's here.
I tell you what, hang on 1 second. I can tell you. Let's see. Okay. Patrick or Terry? Hey, Terry, can you type in that you can hear Wade? If you can hear him,
let us know. Morning, Terry.
Okay. He says he can see your screen in here, so you're on your own, Wade.
Okay, guys, listen, you'll be glad to know that David did not bring me in to show you how to operate a computer, because I'm a little bit technically challenged. However, he did bring me in to talk a little bit about manufactured home communities, which I do have experience in. I've been working them for the last 20 years or so. So perhaps I can save you guys a little bit of time and heartache if it's an investment that you have some interest in. So I'm going to go through some details about my bio and kind of my experience, and I'm going to then maybe show you kind of how we gauge a community, manufactured home community, how we value manufactured home community, and then I'm going to show you some examples of some of the communities that I've owned and operated and worked on. So moving forward. All right, so I started my first business back in 1992. I operated American Kitchen and Bath, and we sold cabinets, countertops, hardwood flooring, vinyl, tile, and all the stuff that both builders and remodelers would use. So about 4 years after starting that business, I naturally, having worked on so many houses, started to buy fixer houses and really found my true love, real estate. I had spoken with several people over the years as I was doing my kitchen, American Kitchen and Bath business, and kind of got excited about real estate. And so once I started doing the fix and flip, I was in Denver. I figured out after a few years that I had basically created myself a job, and it wasn't exactly what I was looking for. I was kind of looking to transition into something that was more of a residual income. So I started looking at various types of rentals, and in 1999, one of my customers in Denver had some fourplexes in Irving, Texas. It was a 32-unit complex that he wanted to sell, and we struck up a deal. So I did my first commercial deal in 1999 and moved to Texas from Denver. Since then, I've done four apartment complexes. Other than that first one, they were passive with Canis Major, that is. I've done seven manufactured home communities, totaling about 600 spaces. Those have been all active. I've been involved in three full service car washes and a dry cleaning plant. None. Land home deals, numerous manufactured home deals, and flips. So I've got a little bit of experience. I've been doing this for, 20 plus years, and that's why I'm here to talk a little bit about that. So why would you have an interest in manufactured homes versus, say, apartment complexes or car washes or storage facilities? In my opinion, it's my first love. I really love the manufactured home business. I feel like it has certainly a higher yield per se than other asset classes. That's changing a little bit, but the yield is presented simply because of the lack of knowledge that many investors have had over the years of the park business. However, again, that is changing. So my number one item on the top of that, higher yields, I've got to say that yield is probably coming down a little bit, but the other aspects of manufactured home communities have not changed. First and foremost, it's ease of management. Unlike an apartment complex, with a park, you are in somewhat more control simply because people own their homes in the park, in the community, and they don't want to have to move them. It's very expensive to move them. And so, as we try to enforce rules, and our rules are always fair, of course, it just becomes easier. We've got more sway with people. Parks themselves have very limited new competition coming into the market simply because cities don't have a high desire to bring in new parks, albeit that's starting to change, and I think that's going to create some new opportunity. I'm working with one of my properties right now to add on to it, and I think that's going to be a great learning experience as I get through that process, and maybe the next new frontier of developing new parks as we've got a limited supply of lower cost housing. Part of the barrier that we have in parks, again, is the cost of moving a house. It can cost $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to move a home from one park to another park or even to a piece of land. And so people don't obviously have, big chunks of money sitting around. Obviously, they can save it, but it creates just this nice little barrier or comfort level for us. They are more of a long-term tenant versus an apartment complex. And I really like that. It really helps us to be able to enforce how we want to change a community when we come into it. I feel like parks, more so than most other assets, are inflation-proof. As the economy improves and occupancy rates are higher, we can raise our rents, unlike other communities, such as apartment complexes, where a new structure, a new facility is built, maybe right next door or across the road, and your prices are driven down. We don't have that competition. It's kind of a unique situation in that we're not necessarily competing against apartment complexes, but even when we are, we can provide a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house at a couple hundred dollars lower than what a competitive apartment complex would be charging for those rents, and they're buying them. We don't rent homes personally. We owner finance them. That's just our business model. Some communities do rent. We'll talk a little bit about that, but my preference is to do a lease with an option to purchase. We've also got a huge market that is coming online with all the aging baby boomers and the millennials, both that like a lower cost home. For some strange reason, the millennials, maybe I need to do some market research on that, but they tend to like smaller homes. So this is a great market for millennials and for an expanded market. So obviously with any asset, there are some cons. And I think that the biggest thing would be same thing that creates the competition or creates what we have is the limited supply. So when you're out there in the market looking for new property, new products, there is a big limited supply. And if it's a community that is over 100 spaces or close to 100 spaces, you've got big money coming in from Wall Street that's investing in it, pushing prices up. It's kind of interesting. There's a gentleman named Dave Reynolds who started the Mobile Home Park Store, which lists mobile home parks. And he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal back in the 90s. And ever since then, you've gotten Wall Street involved in purchasing up communities. And it's driven the cap rates down tremendously. Every community that I've sold has been to an ex-Goldman Sachs investor, strangely enough. So yeah, there's big money involved in it, and you've got a limited supply. So when you get out in the marketplace and you start looking for communities, you know, how are we going to determine value? So like most other apartment complexes, we're similar in that. It's not much different. You're going to look typically at 2 years profit and loss and the trailing 12, a year-to-date P&L, a current rent roll, and see what recent capital expenditures have been put into the community. And can some of those capital expenditures be removed? So after determining value, where do we find our upside? Obviously, the easiest thing is can we raise rents? If we're buying a community that already has low rents, you can raise value on it immediately by bringing them up to market. Now, some communities may need some work to be done prior to that. And that is definitely some cost that's going to be added in. But what I'm seeing in the marketplace is a lot of communities are coming in if they've got a budget already set up and the work set up that they're going to do on a community, they're raising the rents day one. So that adds value right off the bat and gives you capital to work with. Obviously, filling vacancy is a little bit more cost prohibitive just because you're buying homes or you're rehabbing homes. But the first thing I always do is I individually meter utilities, water. Right off the bat, by putting water in, which is relatively expensive, or metering in for the water, my water bill is cut in half. People are now paying attention to what they're using water for. And that always saves me a lot of money. Not only that, the tenants are now paying for their water. Another policy I've always used is I've tried to add spaces on to any available land that I've had in communities. That's one of the deals I'm working on right now, as previously mentioned, adding 68 spaces to one of my existing communities. Optimizing expenses, trash is always a big one. Quite often, you know, people have the same trash company for 5 years, 10 years, however long they've had it, and they can save money by just cutting trash. Obviously, looking at the internet and the telephone and management and maintenance. Those are two big things that quite often can be streamlined. If you have multiple communities, obviously you can take advantage of the maintenance staff. if you don't have multiple communities and you're just starting out, that's something you're always going to want to look at. Is the community ran to its optimum? And if it's not, changing management and or maintenance is always a good idea if needed. I wouldn't do that day one unless you've already got somebody in line, because you're going to learn a lot from both the manager and the maintenance people. But it's something to always keep in mind. So when you go out there in the marketplace, just like apartment complexes, you're going to look at different types of manufactured home communities. There's a system that was designed some time ago. It's the STAR system. It's not used by everybody any longer. Some people have gone to a different system for gauging parks, but I still use the STAR system. I've understood it and used it for a long time. So what I'd like to do is maybe show you guys some pictures of what would be an example of a one-star, two-star, and so on through up to a five-star. So let's start with a one-star. Now, this is kind of the idea that everybody has of a trailer park. And unfortunately, this is the idea that many people have of our industry. But this is far from the norm. These are becoming fewer and fewer between, simply because people are buying them up and they're fixing them. If there's enough spaces on here, this is still a great opportunity. It's something that you're going to have to sink some capital in, so you're going to want to buy it really well in order to have the capital to sink in and have it make sense. If this is the type of community you want to buy and operate in this standard, I would stay away from it, simply because that type of a community is going to attract a certain type of person, and that's just not who I want to deal with. However, if you're buying it to fix it and turn it into a nice community, I'm all for that. Love that idea. Our next property would be more of a two-star community. It's going to have probably road-based roads, no driveways, concrete driveways or asphalt driveways. It's not going to have any amenities, but it's going to start to take a layout like, this is a mobile home park. Skirting may or may not exist. Tongues may or may not be on the homes, but it's going to be a dry bones, nothing fancy, just a place to live and park your home. As you start getting into the 2.5, 3-star communities, this is typically where I play. These are the properties I tend to look at. They've got established roads, whether they be concrete or asphalt. They may or may not have driveways. I typically will put driveways in. I've done that on several of my communities. I always use concrete because that's going to last a lot longer. It may or may not have skirting and tongues removed on all of the homes. But again, it's a clean neighborhood. It's more than likely got some issues, but it's a solid potential to work with, and the rents can be raised, whether it be because they're low or because the market is going to take them up. This is a great opportunity. I love 2.5, 3-star parks. I have done a couple of nicer communities. More of the 3 and the 4, the 4 and the 5-star communities. Don't mind those either if there's some upside somewhere. Are the rents low? Is there a place to move in vacant homes or fill vacant spaces? Excuse me. Do the roads need to be redone? Does it need to be metered? There's always some opportunity if you're buying from somebody that hasn't already taken advantage of that opportunity. And that's kind of what I'm looking for. But this is where you start to get into a nicer community, nicer facilities. Again, it'll have asphalt roads, it'll have driveways, it may have a clubhouse, the crime is low, and the homes are typically 10 to 15 years or newer. Now, as you start getting into the 4-star parks, you've got typically most of the amenities. You've got the clubhouse, you've got the swimming pool, you've got the driveways. You've got the curb and gutter, but but you may also have some older homes. These are nicer communities. There may be some upside in them still, but it's something you're going to have to search out. And then finally, as you get into the five-star communities, it's got everything that a community could offer. It's got the pool, it's got the security gates, the security camera, it's got the big spaces. They may offer lawn mowing throughout the entire community. It has well laid out roads, curb and gutter, sidewalks, really nice communities. This is something I may eventually move into as I age and get older and don't want to do all of the heavy lifting that I've done on all of these parks in the past. But this is the type of community that, you know, you're not afraid to let grandma walk around in at night. It's a nice community. So once you've come across a property that you have an interest in and the numbers make sense, how do you go about financing it? Well, it depends. If you're looking at that one-star park, you may not have a whole lot of options available. As you get up into the two and the three-star park and the four-star park, the options open up. Local bank financing, certainly on a two-star park, even on a one-star park, you might have an option for local bank financing if the land is in a great area and they see potential if the deal goes south. I'll show you a park a little bit later on that was the situation that I bought in San Antonio. And the only reason the lender lent on that park was because of where it's at. Local bank financing is not going to be as competitive. You're going to put more money down, you're going to have a shorter amortization period, and you're going to pay a higher interest rate. Most likely, it's going to be full recourse or a personal guarantee. As you get into the bigger, nicer communities, you've got other options open to you, CMBS, FHA. I'm in the process of refinancing one right now, and we're looking at FHA. The terms are amazing. I mean, they'll go 30-year AM, maybe as low as 4.25%. They offer options to be able to pull additional capital out at least one time later on in the loan. And they're even locking them for up to 10 years now. So these are typically non-recourse, unless you go with a CMBS, that is. FHA is non-recourse. These are great loans, but it's got to be the right property to acquire that type of a loan. The last option, which I've taken advantage of a couple of times, is owner financing. I'm working on one right now where the owner wants a little bit of capital. They're retiring, and they want to get some payment. So they'll have some capital in the bank, and they'll have some monthly payments coming in. So of all the deals I've done, two of them have been owner financed. A third one could have been, but I just found better terms at a local bank. So something to keep in mind, there's a lot of options open in this industry. So when I take over a community, I tend to have a list. What I like to do is beforehand, I want to go in and understand, all right, what are we going to do in this community? How are we going to improve the numbers? How are we going to improve the occupancy? The first thing I always do, as previously mentioned, is if there's no water meters, I meter the water, day one. We do it immediately. If there is any debris, older homes, vacant homes, anything that needs to be cleaned out, I bring in the dump trucks, bring in the mini excavator, and we clean that stuff out. We get it cleaned up. So within a few days, there's a noticeable change. Something's going on here. I put out notices to everybody that, all right, this is the new ownership. Here's where we're at. This is the direction that we're going to go. Here's what's going to be required of you. Once we've done that, people start to see that, all right, this new owner is serious about what they're doing, and they start to take it seriously. I typically, on a rougher park, I've had to enforce rules and evict some people, which always gets everybody's attention. They start to realize that, okay, these guys are serious, and we move forward with that. I don't have to do that for very long, but quite often in the beginning, that's pretty normal. The next thing I'll do is I'll set up a welder, and if the community has tongues on the homes, I'll set up a welder to come in, and they'll charge somewhere from $25 to $50 per home. And I'll have them cut off all the tongues in the park, and they slide them underneath the house. The next thing we'll do is force everyone to replace their skirting if their skirting is ugly or damaged or old. I will finance that skirting for people. It runs about $1,000 per home, but it is a dramatic improvement on the look of the park immediately. Older homes, if they're not in too bad of condition, will allow people to paint, repair older unattractive homes. If they're a good tenant, obviously we're gonna cut more slack to it. If it's a bad tenant and a bad home, we'll probably just force them out. Once we've accomplished all of this, the entire community is taking on a new look without a ton of money spent already. You may even start having people come in and ask about moving homes into your park. I also look at repo homes, which are becoming more and more limited just because the economy's been so strong for the last 10 years or so, that the repos are less and less available. So for the last year or so, I've started buying new homes and owner financing the new homes. You may need to update the signs, update the phone numbers, and seal coating on asphalt. Much of those things can be done relatively inexpensive. I don't consider them heavy lifting. I just consider those cleanup, but it changes the dynamics of the community quickly and dramatically. So just kind of wanted to show some pictures of kind of before. Unfortunately, that truck right there is blocking the view of what this looked like prior. But this is the community in San Antonio that we took over in late 2016. We acted exactly as previously mentioned, forcing everyone to remove tongues and taking off the skirting and cleaning up the debris. Go through some pictures a little bit later about kind of how we dramatically changed this community moving forward. This was, again, same community, just cleaning up debris and mowing and forcing people to skirt. Small picture, but it kind of gives an idea of how much cleaner it looks. It just starts to look like somebody cares a little bit. Older homes, we, you know, when they're older like this, in this condition, unless they're in very good shape, we start to try and push them out, you know, maybe get people in newer homes or finance a home for them, or if they're just not a good tenant, then we move forward and just get them out of the community. As we get further along, these are the type of homes that I'm moving in. Older, newer or new, picking up the look of the community, giving it a fresh look and much easier to sell. A little bit bigger payment for people, but people like a newer home, and they want to live when they see the community changing. This is kind of where we go. A lot of times we'll work with dealers in the area on these newer homes because we can get the dealers. If it's a tight market like we have here in Texas, we can get a dealer to move in a home and sell it there in the park. I don't charge them lot rent while it's being sold, but once it's sold, moving forward, it's always charged lot rent. So as you get into some of the communities, the lift gets a little bit heavier. And what I mean by that is fixing the infrastructure, the roads, the parking pads. These are what I've had to do on a number of my communities. I think we've done asphalt and driveways on four of the communities that I've done. So a lot of times they'll start out looking like this. We'll work through them and start grading the roads and tearing up the old asphalt, milling it out if need be, or an overlay, either way, whatever's needed. I tend to like pavilions, like you see over here on the right-hand side. I've started putting those in all of my communities to give a nice park setting. Some parking benches, barbecues, kind of to give more of a family atmosphere in the communities. It's more before and after pictures, just, you know, the difference that seal coating, the upper picture, that was just a seal coat. We didn't need any heavy asphalt on that. Streaks were still in good shape, but just a seal coat gives it a really nice, fresh look. The lower picture, that one needed, we milled out that entire community and we put asphalt everywhere on that. This was, this community on the lower side was 140 space park and it needed quite a bit of infrastructure work. We bought it well, it left us capital on the table to do it. And this is a completely different community after all the work we've done on it. So we're in a situation right now that finding new spaces, finding new parks for sale is getting more and more difficult, as previously mentioned. And so as mentioned, adding spaces to a community is kind of the next step. And so this is a property that we've worked on the engineering. We have got the plans at the city. We've got a hiccup with a couple of fire departments that we still need to get through, but this is the next thing on my agenda since I've just recently finished up another project. So as you can see, the little roads here, we've designed a system of cul-de-sacs and roads. They've got one that goes through, and that's gonna add 68 spaces. And it's amazing what the addition of 68 to the already existing 140 spaces does to the bottom line. It's really dramatic because you obviously aren't purchasing the land is already involved, and the terms that you're able to get this new stuff built at compared to what this community was purchased at, it's pretty dramatic. So bottom line, it'll more than double it with the addition of the 68 spaces. So this is another community. This one's in San Antonio. And this is a project that I'm just finishing up now. So I'm gonna show you some pictures of what we did on this one. It had 46 spaces, but 19 of those spaces, all of the vacant stuff you see over here, the previous owner cleared the utilities out because he was gonna turn it into a different type of business. He never completed it, but he left everything unusable. So it's been somewhat time consuming working with the city of San Antonio to get all that infrastructure put back in there, but we've finally gotten that complete and we're in the process of finishing up the property and filling it. So this property right here, I wanted to show you some of the before pictures of how rough this thing was. And as I had mentioned, local financing and a bank lending on it. This is a property that was in right east of Alamo Heights here in San Antonio. So it's in a potentially great area. The direction that movement is going is towards this park, albeit it's in a still a tough area. But this is the condition of the community when we took it over. I mean, it was just rough. It was trash stored everywhere. There was overgrowth. There was ratty old homes. It was just a terrible place. It's shocking that people would have lived in this community. This was a property just waiting for a lawsuit to happen. One of the tenants in there, as an example, had a water leak. And the water was running from his bathroom outside of his house to the front driveway, creating a puddle the size of a small pond in his front yard, covered with moss. And then it was running all the way down the main road. And I don't know how long it had been running like that, but day one after closing on the property, we shut his water off until he could get it fixed. He never did. We ended up evicting him. But the month we closed on it, the water bill on that community was $10,000. And it's a tiny community. The preceding months, when we shut off his water, they dropped down to $2,000. And after metering all of the homes, the water bill fell to under $1,000. So if that tells you anything about metering the water, it's very, very effective at saving expenses. I want you to make note of this structure right over here. That's the potential office in this community. It was a crack house. There were homeless people living all over the place. This building was a restroom that they had broken into and were using it to both live in and use. The community had, it just had debris everywhere. It was extremely unattractive, but it was in the potential path of development. And that's why I liked it. And it's why the lender liked it and why he was willing to move forward with it. So moving forward, I want to kind of show you what we've done to that community. This is one of the three entrances. We have put wrought iron fences up, stone pillars. We've replaced all the issues with water and sewer. We've moved out all of the older homes that were in disrepair. We've obviously put new asphalt in. We put concrete driveways in every space. We've improved every aspect of this community. This is a community now that every new home we move into, we've already got a buyer for it. So it's really changed dramatically. We just completed that this Monday. So looking forward to getting that thing filled up and producing for us. So that's a little before and after. Quite a difference. I'm going to show you a before and an after on what it looked from the aerial. This one was October of 2016. This one was January of this year. So quite a dramatic change. So how do you find parks? Well, that's an interesting thing. It's like every asset right now. The market is tough. People are overpaying for stuff. So what do? One thing you can do is go to loopnet.com and you'll find stuff on there. Albeit there's not much anymore simply because of all the buyers in the market, but you're going to be paying retail on loopnet.com. It's like the MLS. Same thing with Mobile Home Park Store. There's a lot of duplicate stuff on both of those sites. I've been pretty effective with knocking on doors and talking to owners. It's really been the most effective method I've found for finding deals, stuff that makes some sense. Texas, according to mobilehome.net, has about 3,153 parks in the state of Texas. So there's some opportunity, albeit far fewer than apartment complexes or storage facilities. There's a lot of owners out there, mom and pop type shops that maybe they've been there for 25, 30 years. I'm working on one such deal right now. And that's exactly it. She's owner operated it for 25 years and she's just ready. She's ready to be done and retire and move on. And because of that, there's some upside there with filling vacant spaces, raising the rents. And that's how deals are really had in this day and age. So that's really the best thing that I can say. Now it's interesting for any of you that were at the Santa Rita at the meeting on Tuesday night, Shinoa presented a chart up there about contacts, about how many contacts it takes to close a deal. And I like that. It's actually very helpful. The percentages, albeit I didn't probably should have included it on this, but the percentages were extremely low for one, two, or three contacts with a seller. And it became obvious that it's typically going to take 12 to 16 contacts to close a deal. So what I'm going to say to everybody is be diligent, be patient. Sometimes these deals take, well, this one I'm working on right now, I've been working on it for 2 years. The pictures of the previous park that we did the full rehab, that too was 2 years. I say be patient. I'm going to give you a short story about a time when I lost my patience and one of my buddies ended up with the community. This was a park in Fort Worth I'd been looking at and talking to the owner for, I don't know, it was a year, year and a half. And I went over there, drove over there, and it was way out of my way. And spoke with the guy numerous times, and a couple of times he's like, I'm ready to sell. And I'd get over there and he'd be like, well, not today. Well, the last time he did that to me, I lost my cool. I threw the contract down, I ripped it up and left. I was done with the deal. I was just finished. I spoke to a buddy of mine. It couldn't have been 6 months later, and you know, just asked him, hey, what are you up to? What are you doing? Oh, I'm working on this community in Fort Worth. And I asked him, which one? Sure enough, he bought the deal. And there was $1 million sitting on the table right there that I let go. So what I say again is be patient and be diligent. And if you've got any questions, I think that's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to help out any way I can. Any questions, guys? If anybody is presenting any questions, again, I'm a little bit technically challenged. I may just not see them. Okay, if we've got no questions, then we can probably end the presentation. Okay, guys, I guess that's a wrap. We'll call it a day. Thank you.